You blinked and you missed it. So I've been doing a lot of interviews today, listening to people's stories. And as always, on a meditation retreat there, everyone's so different. Everyone has their own very distinct kinds of experiences that they have. And yet something that we share is that inside us we intuitively know that we long for something peaceful. We don't necessarily know how to find what's peaceful. Or if we do stumble across it accidentally, we don't necessarily know what it means. And yet there still is inside each of us a longing to be free, a longing to be at peace, a longing to be happy. And isn't that kind of a strange thing? Our whole lives we've been trapped. Our whole lives we've been restless. Our whole lives we've been suffering. We've never known real freedom, real peace, real happiness. We've seen glimpses of it, we've had partial experiences of it, we know what it means somehow, but we've never really seen what those things are in their fullness. And it's hard even to know or to describe or to think about what those things really mean. If I was to ask, what does real freedom mean? It's a very challenging concept, it's something it's easy to talk about. But it's hard to know what it really means. And yet, despite that, despite the fact that we don't quite know what it is that we're longing for, we know that we still long for it. And we know that wherever it is that we are now, it could be a bit better. Many of you have had glimpses, either in your meditation or at some other time, glimpses of a better way of being, of a more clear consciousness, of a more settled mind. Even if it's only a glimpse, it's very interesting that those kinds of experiences are quite common and they're very memorable. Those experiences that lift you out of yourself, lift you out of the mundane, a transcendent experience. And so we come to meditation looking for something that can provide some more peace, some more depth, some more meaning. Sometimes we find it, sometimes we don't. But along the way, on the journey, we learn so much about who we are, what it is we're doing, how we're thinking, how we're feeling. And sometimes at the end of a retreat, you feel that sense of longing is even keener. You'll be reassured to know that there's actually a Pali word for that, that the Buddha said is called Niramisa Domanasa, means spiritual depression. Right? So you thought you were bad off already. You had an ordinary depression. And now you've got spiritual depression as well. A hassle. So what's spiritual depression? It's precisely that. It's precisely that feeling that why am I trapped here? Why can't I be free? Isn't there a better way? Why is it, right? Why is it that I know what's right? I know what I should be doing, right? I know I should be doing meditation every day. I know I should be letting go. I know I shouldn't be holding on to all of these enmities and... But I do. I do hold on. And I don't meditate as much as I'd like to. And I suffer, and I know that I'm suffering, and I know that I can not suffer, and yet I still keep doing those things. Why is that? So this is that spiritual depression. For me anyway, it's very, very reassuring to know that there's a Pali word for things. You know, oh, okay, it must be real. And but this is something the Buddha talked about. And so, of course, as well as that spiritual depression, there's also the spiritual happiness, the niramisa sukha. Which the Buddha also talked about, and in fact, talked about much, much more often. I mean, actually, there's only like two or three references in all of the Buddha's discourses to the spiritual depression. It's quite an unusual and striking thing, but the spiritual happiness is something that he talked about pretty much every second discourse talks about. And if there's one emotion which is the most crucial in all of the Buddha's path, then it's happiness. Happiness is the path to peace. It's very tempting, and I think a very elementary confusion that we make in our spiritual life, that we see that the way of the world is a search for pleasure. So we see people out in the world always looking for food or sex or clothes or possessions or big houses or fast cars or some kind of pleasure or happiness. And so it's very easy to assume that the spiritual path is a path away from pleasure. And we see that it's actually very common in spiritual paths, both Western and Eastern, to be very afraid of pleasure. In my own experience, when I first started Buddhist meditation, my first retreat, as soon as I started getting some joy in my meditation, I was kind of warned off it. Oh, look out, you'll get attached. Oh. I mean, that's not going to be so much of a problem around here. Most of you are students of Ajahn Brahman. Of course, this is one of the things that he emphasizes most strongly, how important that pleasure and happiness is. You know, when I first became a student of Ajahn Brahm, I'd been a monk for a few years in Thailand and gradually got to know Ajahn Brahm's teachings and came here to stay. And I thought that, you know, when I listened to his teachings, I was thinking, okay, that's, you know, he's talking about samadhi and peacefulness of mind and happiness. I thought, you know, that's all right and that's good, but you know, I think for a while I thought he was overemphasizing these things. I thought he was putting too much emphasis on it. And then I did a detailed study of the suttas, which I did as research for my first book, on Swift Pair of Messengers. And I went through and I looked at pretty much every passage in the Buddhist scriptures that talk about meditation, and translated most of them and put them into a book. And at the end of that, I realized, no, actually, the way Ajahn Brahm talks about it is actually pretty much the same emphasis that we find in the suttas. And the Buddha's talking about these things, the peace of mind, the tranquility of mind, again and again and again and again. It's so much emphasized. So if we want to follow the path of the Buddha, this is the bad news. You're just going to have to be happy. No excuses. Right? You're just going to have to grit your teeth and bear it. And I know sometimes it can be, you know, it can seem far away. It can seem remote. And that's why I began this talk talking about the spiritual depression. Because that's also a reality, and that's okay if you feel like that. It doesn't mean you're off the path or anything like that. It's just one of the experiences you have while you're practicing. But the most important feelings, the ones that really matter, are the pleasant feelings, the happy feelings. So unlike, as I said before, unlike many spiritual paths, both Western and Eastern, in Buddhism we shouldn't be afraid of pleasure. And this is something that's not... it's not an interpretation or something like that. It's something which is a major theme of the Buddha's teachings. And before the Buddha was enlightened, he practiced the way of trying to find liberation through suffering. And he practiced tormenting his body to see if he could find freedom through that. And he said that at that time he had this wrong view. He believed that the way to happiness was not by happiness, the way to happiness was by pain. Yeah. And many of us actually, unconsciously I think, we still hold this kind of idea. We think that if something's a real spiritual practice, it's got to hurt a little bit. You know, they did a study of placebos some time ago, and they found that if you give people a sugar pill, right, and then a bitter pill, right? They're both placebos. Right? Neither of them do anything, but they're both effective, but the bitter one is more effective than the sweet one. Yeah. So there's something about the human mind that kind of wants to. If it feels good, it can't be good for you, right? Spinach is good for you. Chocolate isn't. That's how we think. So rather than making that kind of distinction and having that fear of pleasure, the Buddha quite explicitly says, na bhayitabhang, that one should not fear. Na bhayitabhang. There is that pleasure which is not fearful, it's not dangerous. Doesn't have any side effects. It's completely cholesterol free. It's no GM ingredients. Doesn't make you fat. The only problem with the spiritual pleasure is that you get addicted to it. And if you get addicted to it, you know what happens? The Buddha acknowledged this. He said, this is a big problem. He said, somebody accused his monks, he says, your monks are just addicted to pleasure. He says, that's right, they are, they're addicted to pleasure. They're addicted to pleasure in their meditation. Four kinds of pleasure, four jhanas. And you know what the outcome of that, he said, the outcome of that addiction to pleasure is the four stages of enlightenment. So this is the problem. If you have too much pleasure in your meditation, you're going to get enlightened. And then who knows what could happen? So that's the only side effect of having a lot of pleasure in your meditation. All the other side effects are good. Well, not that that's not a good side effect, but... Many people have said to me that during the interviews that, you know, they feel that that they should meditate more, that they like to meditate, they appreciate it, but they found it hard to keep a regular practice going. Yeah. So this is the simplest and best way to keep a regular practice going, is to just really enjoy your meditation. If you try to say, I'm going to keep a regular practice by you know, making a schedule and sticking to it and so on, then, you know, good luck with that. Frankly, all that shows is that you don't understand the first thing about the human mind. Lesson number one, we should have learned this from the story of Genesis, right? You make a rule about it, then the first thing you want to do is break the rule. It's very straightforward. So to if we want to cultivate that long-term meditation practice, don't do that through willpower or through making resolutions or anything like that. You do that by being happy. You do it by finding pleasure in your meditation. You do it so that you love your meditation so much that your problem, you know, listen to how we often phrase those things. We say, oh, my life is so busy, I find it difficult to schedule time for meditation. What if it was the other way around? I just love meditating so much every day, I find it difficult to fit the rest of my life in. I know I should be spending, you know, more time doing the cooking and cleaning the house, and but honestly, I just love to meditate so much, I just find it hard to tear myself away from it. So why is it so important? Why is pleasure so important? Well, like everything else in the Buddhist path, the idea that the role of pleasure is so important doesn't come from... It's not based on a kind of an ideology or a metaphysical idea. It's purely based on just the observation of the human mind. So if we look at how our minds work, essentially we're pleasure-seeking beings, aren't we? We're driven by search for more pleasure and the search to avoid pain. And if we think back over this last day that we've just had at the retreat center together, you know, because you've been meditating and you've had more awareness than you might have normally, and think back and look at all the things that you've done today, and you think about how many of those things have been either searching for pleasure or trying to escape from pain. Yeah, what did it feel like when you woke up this morning? Yeah, what was your kind of first thought, right? First thought is, right, to avoid the pain of getting up in the cold morning, yeah, and enjoy the pleasure of snuggling under the blankets for just a little bit longer. Well, anyway, that was my first thought, I don't know about you. Yeah. And right from that first moment, our mind is always being pulled and pushed in these different directions. Again, it's not to say that there's anything wrong with it, that's just how minds work. That's how psychology works. When we need something to what motivates us, what moves us. So it's not about judging it. It's just about understanding how that works. So if we want to develop our spiritual life, then we need to find a way where we can work with our mind and not working against it. So we find a way of practicing, a way of meditating, where we can experience that kind of happiness. Pulls the mind towards that kind of happiness. And one of the things that we notice about that kind of happiness is it has quite a different quality to the happiness we experience in worldly pleasures. And again, this is not a question of judging one's right, one's wrong, one's good, one's bad. It's just a question of understanding these different kinds of experience. For example, if you have in worldly pleasures, one of the most obvious characteristics of them is that they get used up very quickly. I remember once when I was with a friend of mine as a monk, a junior monk in Thailand, and his mum was visiting, and we went out with his mum, and she took us to this cafe or something like that, and we had ice cream sundaes. And that's like really exciting when you're a young monk in Thailand. Ice cream sundaes, like wow. And after we ate them, then the other monks just looked at me and said, you know, I knew it would be impermanent, but did it have to be that impermanent? So the first ice cream sundae is good, the second one not so much. Even the first bite of the ice cream sundae is good. The second one's a little bit not quite so good as the first one. Yeah? And that's how it always is. Every kind of sense pleasure that we have. I mean, the greatest example of that is drug addiction. I remember hearing once an interview on the radio with an author. He used to be a crack addict. And he said that, for the first time he ever took crack, it was just so unbelievable. Just completely blew his mind. He felt more alive than he'd ever had in his life. And within such a short time, it was over. And he just had this hunger in him to experience that again. And just went looking and looking and looking to find more and more and more. And he never experienced that same high again, no matter how much he took. Until he ended up just ruining his life, living literally just living in the gutter. Everything gone. Just seeking that same pleasure. I mean, that's a very extreme example, but that's where it goes if we follow these pleasures to an extreme. So normally we know that we have to be moderate with these things, and that's one of the things that we're taught by our mum when we're growing up. There's no great secret, is it, right? You eat all of that cake, you're going to be sick, right? So you eat it all and you get sick. And you do that usually quite a few times. Anyway, I did. And eventually you kind of learn, one piece of cake is all right, but not the whole thing. And so we learn moderation. We learn that we can have those pleasures, but we have them in moderation, and then it's okay. And so we're always trying to negotiate it. We're always trying to get as much as we can without getting the side effects. The kind of classic example is that we find in food these days, where you always find something advertised as like fat-free. Right? So you see the sign on it, fat-free, and you can guarantee it's like at least 40% sugar. Yeah? Or you get the one that says sugar-free, and of course it's loaded with fat. Yeah? So again, that's how it is. We're always kind of negotiating, trying to get our way into trying to get the pleasure without having the drawbacks. So when we come to the spiritual pleasure and the pleasure of meditation, it's not like that at all. The more we have of the experience, the deeper it becomes. You don't use it up. Right? You don't have to sort of juggle it and manipulate it so that you can keep having that pleasure. the more you go into it, the deeper the pleasure becomes. And it's something that you don't just experience in passing, it's something which you can experience for a long time. You can sit there and just feel that deep contentment in your whole body. And of course, the biggest difference between the pleasure in meditation and other kinds of pleasure is that you're not dependent on anything. You can just be anywhere. As long as you've got somewhere to just be quiet for a few minutes, and you can sit down and be and experience that contentment and that happiness within yourself. So it gives you a great confidence, and it's very empowering. So, how are we to go? How do we proceed? If we want to experience that pleasure, well, of course, any of the kinds of meditation, you know, you can use for that, but that's one of the specific things that metta meditation is very good for, loving kindness meditation. Yeah. Makes your mind very happy very quickly. If you're doing breath meditation is a wonderful practice, but one of the drawbacks that it has for some people is that sometimes it can be a bit dry, and you're just watching the breath come in and out, and it's just air coming in and out, and it doesn't mean anything, and it's, you don't feel any connection with it. Now, it's possible to work with that and to feel the breath as something that's very pleasurable and very beautiful. But practicing metta meditation is another way, which is perhaps the fastest way to experience that pleasure in your meditation. Now, I talked this morning about doing metta for oneself. So hopefully you've had the chance to practice that a little bit today. Now, I'm going to teach a couple of stages of the meditation this evening. And so we have the chance to try it out. But don't be in too much of a hurry. Like when we're doing that practice, doing the metta meditation practice, just take your time. Little bit by little bit. So the method that's taught by my teacher, Ajahn Mahachapchai in Thailand, he taught a method that has four stages of loving kindness meditation. These are like four preliminary stages anyway. That's the first one, the metta for loving kindness for oneself, for a loved person, a disliked person, and a neutral person, and lastly a disliked person. So it's four people: oneself, a loved one, a neutral person, and a disliked person. And the idea is that with this practice we develop loving kindness for each one of those four people in turn, until we have the experience which is just as deep and as powerful for all of those four people. Until there's no difference in our mind, in our heart, there's no difference at all in the love that we feel for ourselves, in the love we feel for someone who's very close to us, or in the love we feel for our worst enemy. There's no difference at all. So this ideal that we have, right? We have that idea, love your enemy, which is a beautiful ideal, but it's one which is much easier to say than it is to do. And through this metta meditation, we can learn what that really means. It's something that's very, very profound. It's not just an idea that you just kind of, oh yeah, love your enemy, yeah, good. Whatever. But to really have that mind that can't find any difference between anybody in the world, It's very rare. And so to fully experience that is what we call in the meditation term for it is called Sima Sambhedha, which means the breaking down of the barriers. It means there's no difference between anybody in the world. Okay, so to get to this state of universal loving kindness, we go step by step. We've already talked about doing loving kindness for oneself. For this evening, I want to talk about doing loving kindness for a loved person. So that should be easy, shouldn't it? Right? Somebody that do metta for somebody that you love. And generally speaking, this stage of meditation is not so difficult, but of course, love is a slightly complex thing, isn't it? Well, so the songwriters say, right? And often we find that our feelings of love for somebody are mixed up with other feelings. It's very rare that we have that pure love. So one of the tricks to doing metta meditation well is that we don't have to think of every loved person when we're doing it. Okay? It doesn't have to be everyone. Nor does it even have to be the person that you love the most. In fact, the person that you love the most is often a bit complicated. And one time I was teaching this part of the meditation when I was in Singapore, and I remember it very clearly. I said, we don't want any twisted and perverse love-hate relationships here. And there was this couple at the front, immediately looked at each other. Right? So that's how it is often. If the people that you love the most, right, that you're closest to, they're also the people that annoy you the most. Yeah. So rather than choosing the person that you love the most, make it the person that you love the simplest. The person that you love the most, with the most naive, childlike love. Without any complications or issues. Maybe parent or brother or sister, might be a child or nephew, niece, grandchild, grandparent. And so in the meditation, we just have to have one person. It doesn't have to be everyone. If you try to list all the people that you love in the meditation, it'll take a long time. Or maybe it takes a very short time and then you get depressed. You know, or maybe may Uncle Fred be happy and Uncle Bill be happy and Aunt Sally be happy and Aunt Frieda, well, maybe not Aunt Frieda. Well, yeah, okay. You see, So you don't want to make it too complicated. Just keep it simple. They usually advise when you're doing metta meditation also not to do metta for somebody who's passed away. Mike or Dania, can I ask you to turn the microphone down a little bit? It's ringing a bit loudly. Thanks. So don't do metta for somebody who's passed away. This is only talking about actually during the meditation. Outside of the meditation, that's fine. You want to dedicate merit to somebody or whatever, that's fine. But actually in the meditation itself, not to do it for someone who's passed away. Why is that? Well, the most obvious reason is because, you know, if you do metta for somebody, they get attracted by that and they'll come and visit you and see you. And that could be very disturbing. You're sitting there meditating, oh, may Aunt Sally be happy, and then she comes and she appears before you in the meditation and says, hi, how's it going? And then you scream and everybody's meditation is disturbed, so it's not good. But leaving aside ghost visitations, it can also raise up more complex emotions, so that you maybe feel grief or loss or all those kinds of things. It tends to be stirred up again. So again, in the meditation, we want to keep it simple. Right, so remember this, meditation is not the time for sorting out your issues. Right? Meditation's a time, that's not our purpose. The purpose of meditation isn't to resolve your issues. The purpose of meditation is to develop these wholesome emotions. And so to develop them, we create an environment, we create a set of conditions which are carefully designed and carefully put into place to give us as much support as we can, to make the job as easy as possible. Right? It's going to be hard enough, so don't make it any harder. Right? So then, of course, people then want to know, well, if you do that, you know, will this person know about it? Right, so if you do meditation, do metta for Uncle Bill, will he know about it? What do you think? Will Uncle Bill know? You don't think he will? Probably depends on Uncle Bill a bit, doesn't it? Well, I can't answer that question, but all I would say is that from a Buddhist point of view, that we should have an inquiring mind. So if you want to do that, you should test it, right? So you do the meditation at 7:30, and then the next day you ring up Uncle Bill, you say, how's it going, Uncle Bill? What were you doing at 7:30 last night? Have any special feelings? Anything happen? Notice anything out of the ordinary? So you do the test. So I don't know about that, and I do think that it's the case that I think our mind has an energy to it, and that energy influences people around us in subtle ways that we're not quite aware of all the time. I think that's happening all the time. And obviously, you know, when you're doing it through meditation, then that's, I think, amplified and purified. So I think that's going on. I mean, certainly that when you do the metta and so on, it will tend to be then expressed through your body, through your speech, through how you are with other people when you meet them as well. So don't think that the metta is something that's just kind of locked up in the meditation. It has flow on effects. And this is maybe getting a little bit off the topic, but it's probably worth mentioning. Even though what we're doing in metta meditation especially, but actually also in any meditation, right, it will affect how you are outside of the meditation, okay? Obviously, right? But, and this is the important thing, it doesn't affect that in any simple and direct way, okay? It affects what happens outside of your meditation in complex and indirect ways. And the way that it affects that isn't determined by your meditation. Okay, it's influenced by it, but it's not determined by it. Okay? So what do I mean by this? Well, let's say you do some metta meditation. You come out of the meditation, you feel good. You have that loving kindness through you and all that stuff just feels good. Yeah, you walk out, you greet your husband, and you give him a nice smile and a nice hug and say, how are you this morning, darling? And you're very happy. So in that way, you can see there's a you know, straightforward relationship, you know, between the meditation and how you're interacting with other people. And that's very positive, and that's normal, and that happens a lot. But that's not the only way that it might affect you. It also affects you in different ways because your mind is complex. Okay? Let's say what happens later on. You get into a conflict with somebody at work, and how do you resolve the conflict? And you're like, may you be happy at them. Here's a kind of passive aggressive loving kindness, may you be happy. And this kind of conceit comes into it, right? You think, oh, I've done my metta meditation. You don't necessarily think like this, but you start behaving as if it's the case. I've done my metta meditation, therefore I'm a better person than you are. And you have all this anger in you, but I can't possibly have this anger, right? Because I've done my metta meditation and I don't have anger. I know that I don't have anger. And these feelings that I'm having now, well, no, it's just whatever. It's a feeling. This can't be anger, right? Because I'm too much of a good person because I'm a virtuous meditator, right? So we get that conceit, which is not, the problem is not the meditation. The problem is that we get conceit around the fact that of us being a meditator. And then that can be used and that can be distorted in ways that can be unhealthy or harmful. Right? Again, it's not to say that there's a problem with the meditation, but there's a problem in how we respond to the meditation. So the point that I'm trying to make here, again, this is the point that I'm making, that the meditation doesn't determine what happens afterwards. It influences it. But how you behave depends on the choices you make when you behave. How you behave when you talk to someone depends on the choices you make when you speak to them. Okay? Doesn't depend on the meditation you did that morning. Yeah? So these are two separate things. What you're doing in your meditation is one thing. How you take that experience in meditation and then integrate it and apply it in your life, this is another thing. Okay? They're separate kinds of tasks. Both of them equally important. Yeah? And of course they will be mutually supportive. The more that you can take that the loving kindness and the peace you have from your meditation and apply it in your life, right, then the better that will be. The more you'll have kindness and generosity and giving and so on in your life. But also, the more that you have those qualities of kindness and generosity and giving, then the easier it will be for you to meditate. Right? So once again, there's no simple, straightforward relationship between these, but they will tend to reinforce each other. And the main thing we have to watch out for is just that conceit that can sometimes come in when we get attached to the idea that we're a good meditator. Of course, if you're a crap meditator, it's not a problem. Anyway, so that was a little bit of a digression, but it was just a bit of a comment on what's going to happen when we go home. You know, usually what happens when you come to meditation retreats is that the first day or so when you're on the retreat, you're thinking about all the things that happened before the retreat, and then the last few days you're thinking about all the things you're going to do when you finish the retreat, right? And so you're sitting there thinking, oh, now I'm really going to get my practice together, I'm going to get up every morning, I've got some momentum going, I'm going to keep that going, get up every morning, I'll do meditation, and so you're sitting there thinking about that rather than actually doing your meditation on the retreat. Anyway, such is the nature of the human mind. Okay, so loving kindness for the second person. Now, remember that I talked about, when I was talking about doing metta for yourself, I talked about doing it, keeping the focus of attention inside your body. So we do the same thing when we're doing metta for a loved person. So that means you're not sort of zapping out there, may you be happy and sending you love rays. Okay? Just keep the awareness inside yourself. Yeah? It's about being grounded and centered. And both of these stages, both the loving kindness for oneself and for a loved person, we kind of develop this ability to spread the mind, the experience of the mind, the experience of metta throughout the whole body. So this is something that comes with time and with practice. When it first arises, a feeling of metta might arise anywhere. It can arise in your heart or in your belly, it can arise anywhere. But as it becomes stronger and more stable, we spread it out and soak it through you until you can feel your whole body become like a body that's suffused with this pleasure of loving kindness. And we should be able to do these two stages, loving kindness for oneself and for a loved person, until we can't really see any difference between them. Until we can go from one to the other, and we look, we see, actually there's no real shift in our mind, the level of metta is pretty much the same. Now if you've given it a shot to do loving kindness for yourself and it's not really working, then what you can do is just start with doing loving kindness for a loved person, and develop that until that's really strong and clear, and then come back and bring it back to yourself. Okay? So it doesn't matter too much what order you do it in, right? You can start with yourself or start with a loved one, doesn't matter too much. But the main thing is at the end of the day that it should be even between those two. Okay? And so when we can do that, we've completed that second stage of metta meditation. So there's a few other stages to talk about I might talk about tomorrow. But that's probably enough for now. So let's do some guided meditation for the next 20 minutes. Sitting quietly. And let the mind settle back inside the body. settled in the heart, you say to oneself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Keeping those words going evenly and steadily. Bringing to mind again and again and again that wish and that longing for one's own true happiness and well-being. increasing as you keep on going with those words of metta. There's also something else, and that's the feeling of metta. Very soft feeling of joy and warmth and love. It rises in the heart or somewhere in your body. Just like the glow around a candle flame. And when you notice that feeling, just keep that close, keep it safe, holding it very gently in your mind. And then taking that same loving kindness, keeping it just as it is, and bringing in the name of that loved person. Not changing anything, just the name in the words of metta. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. Keeping the mind with that feeling of loving kindness soaking and suffusing through your whole body. May that loved one be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Now we're coming near the end of the meditation. From a loved one, come back to oneself. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. And letting the words of metta go. Letting the feeling of loving kindness fade away. And allowing the mind to come back to a neutral space. Empty. Open and clear. Before we finish, just taking a minute to reflect back over that meditation, just to see what happened. How was that? How did the mind change? Was there any feeling of metta there? Or was there nothing? What was useful? What was obstructive? How is my mind different now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And so finally we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize awakening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And you can open your eyes and come out of meditation. Okay, very good. So I've got a basket full of questions here. So I do not know if I'll be able to get through them all this evening. Anyway, I'll do my best. Okay. Dear Bhante, if we show metta to unkind people around us, do you have unkind people around you, or do you just have people who sometimes do unkind things? Anyway, will they not misunderstand us? How could we get metta from others? How can you get metta from others? I do not know. Perhaps you could try eBay? How do we get metta from others? Well, I do know, I think, what the question's getting at. I don't think that we should be concerned with how do we get metta from others, but I do think that there's a sort of a genuine concern that if we go around being nice to everybody all the time, that we can then be taken advantage of. And I think this is really important to understand that. There's a difference between being kind and being stupid, right? And sometimes people feel that, oh, if you have metta and so on, you should never criticize anyone. Actually, there's this interesting, this is something which the Buddha again addressed very explicitly in the suttas, and he talks on this particular question, and they are discussing the question of what do you do when somebody does something wrong? Should they be criticized or not? And then somebody says, well, I should just develop equanimity. If someone does something wrong, then I just have equanimity, so I keep my own heart pure. And the Buddha says, no, that's wrong. If somebody does something worthy of criticism, you should criticize them. Okay? If somebody does something worthy of praise, you should praise them. Right? Praise what's worthy of praise, criticize what's worthy of criticism. That's right speech. Okay? And by avoiding that, and by pretending that we're too nice to criticize anybody, we actually end up just internalizing the problem and end up perpetuating the issue, because obviously bad people or people get away with doing bad and stupid things because all the Buddhists are going around saying, oh, I'm too nice to criticize anyone. That's rubbish. So you have to learn when's the right time to be able to criticize somebody, how to do it in the right way, and to be able to stand up for yourself, right? So having loving kindness means having loving kindness for yourself means that you're not going to be, you're not going to let people walk all over you. Right? If someone's being cruel or being unkind, then have loving kindness for yourself by standing up to them. Right? Have that confidence in yourself. Right? Don't be afraid. Again, if you develop loving kindness, you'll have that confidence. Right? You can stand up for yourself. You can say, no, that's wrong. And we learn to do this, and it's not easy to do. It takes time and it takes practice, and you have to be willing to make mistakes. But you can learn to be able to stand up for yourself without getting angry about it. To be able to speak, and sometimes even if you are angry, right? Not to be in denial of that. Sometimes you are angry, but you have to say something anyway, but you try not to let your anger control you. You try to keep what you say reasonable and fair, even when you're feeling angry. This is your practice of right speech. Okay, next one. Why can I sometimes generate metta and sometimes I can't? What conditions are most conducive to metta meditation? I asked this question of my teacher last time I saw him in Bangkok, the same question, and he said, gentleness. Number one condition, why we can sometimes do metta and sometimes can't. How much gentleness are we bringing into the meditation? How much gentleness have we been practicing before the meditation? How much gentleness have we been using with our own mind? So the mind is very, very interesting. And very, very subtle. I remember I've been meditating for about two or three years, I guess about 3 years. And I was staying in this forest monastery in northeast Thailand called Phujom Kom. And I was walking back the path back to my heart. And I remember one day just walking along this path, and all of a sudden I just had this feeling or this intuition about my own mind, and just suddenly realized how soft and how gentle my mind was. And it was just like this perception that just came to me, you know, after doing all this meditation. I'd never kind of noticed this during all the meditation I'd done. And then suddenly it came, how incredibly delicate and soft your mind is. And we don't notice this because our mind at the same time as being so delicate is also very strong and very resilient, okay? And so we get used to being able to treat our minds in all kinds of terrible ways, right? And we can do all kinds of stuff to it, and somehow our mind recovers, right? But it still hurts. And all of those pain and all that tension and all of that stuff there, it makes its impression and it leaves its mark on the mind. So when we have that perception, you realize how gentle your mind is, how soft it is. And then you would only use it in your meditation in very gentle ways. Okay, next. Why do monks only eat once a day with everything in the same bowl? From the sublime to the even more sublime. Sometimes they eat once a day, sometimes they eat twice a day. It kind of depends. Usually in Bodhnyana anyway, we usually have breakfast, not all the monks have breakfast, but most of the monks have some brekkie. It's up to you. Why? Well, that's what the Buddha did. And he said, this is how I eat, and I eat like that, and I feel good. And I feel strong and healthy and happy, and my body has lots of energy for meditation. So if you eat the same way, then that's how you'll feel as well. Huh? So it's true, that's exactly the reason why the Buddha said to eat that way. It wasn't because of some ascetic practice, it wasn't to sort of force yourself to starve half the day or anything like that. And the reason he said, that's in the Majjhima Nikaya, I can't remember the name of the sutta now, he says, by eating once a day, I am strong and healthy, and my body feels light and fit, and I'm happy for meditation. So that's the reason why we eat like that. Why do you eat everything in the same bowl? Because it's easy for washing up. Like seriously, life's too short for washing up. Can we have more guided metta meditations, please? Well, we just have one, so there you go. Done. Yeah, Bhante, can a person attain enlightenment while doing metta meditation? And metta to you, Bhante. Yes, you can. Easy. You can become enlightened while you're pulling your socks off, or by washing your hands, or even while hanging yourself off a tree. True story. One of the nuns in the Buddhist scriptures, she said, I've wandered for 20 years, and in those 20 years I've never found peace of mind even for as long as the snap of a finger. Right? So at the end of despair, I stood there with a rope around my neck tied to the tree, ready to jump off, and then suddenly my mind was freed. Yeah? So there's another method for you. Okay. Okay, what is love? The feeling and falling in love emotion. How to make sense of that? And how to be free from the stabbing, aching, painful, broken heart? Lots of stuff to digest today. Well, indeed. How to be free from the stabbing, aching, painful, broken heart? Wow. Yeah. What can I say? Well, I think I talked a little bit about that today, both in this session and I think probably more in the morning session, about like the difference with metta and I think the important thing to bear in mind here is, rather than trying to work it out too much, the more that you have metta, the more that you have the real metta, and the real metta, loving kindness for yourself, right, then the less of all of that stabbing, aching, painful, broken heart stuff you'll have. Right? And you'll be free to love. Yeah? Free to love in a way that's giving and caring and sharing, but without so much harsh holding on and so much desperation, so much neediness. Okay? So with your practice of metta, then you have a love that's more giving and less needy. Yeah? And to remember that when you're in love with someone, that somebody doesn't exist to make you happy. Right? That's not real love. Yeah? The purpose of their life is not to make you happy. And so if you love, if you have strong metta in your heart, then when you come into those kinds of relationships, you can do it in a much more healthy way and with a lot less heartbreak involved. Okay. Does noble silence refer to no eye contact and no physical contact too? No, it doesn't. It just means keeping silence. Some retreats actually have a rule that you're not supposed to make eye contact. I think it's a little bit extreme. But no, you can, you know, shake hands or have a hug or something like that. That's okay. And look each other in the eyes and smile. That's fine. Okay. Is everything, including Buddhism itself, an appearance in the mind? Yeah, I guess so, pretty much. But that doesn't mean that it's only an appearance in the mind. Right? In philosophy, we have these two schools of philosophy that we talk about. You have in Western philosophy, and you have similar schools in Eastern Indian philosophy as well, called realism and idealism, right? Realism is the kind of the ordinary everyday attitude we have towards things, that they kind of exist in and of themselves, right? So there's an objective world of rocks and stars and atoms and Toyotas, right? And then there's so this is the kind of idea of realism. And then there's another philosophy, which is the philosophy of idealism, which is basically that all of this only exists in your mind, okay? And that all we can see is a projection of our mind. There were some later schools of Buddhism that kind of flirted with this idea of idealism, and it's been a kind of a minority philosophical point of view in the West as well. But the early Buddhism wasn't an idealist philosophy, so the Buddha never said that the world only exists in your mind, right? Nor was it a realist philosophy. The Buddha didn't say the world exists out there objectively and independently of your mind. The Buddha was a teacher of dependent origination, of the interrelationship of things. So he wasn't concerned with the question about whether the world exists objectively or whether it only exists subjectively. Right? He was concerned with the question of how do we experience the world? Right? How do we feel? How do we know? And that knowing of the world is always a relationship between the objective and the subjective. Okay? So what we know is that, for example, I can see something from here. Right? When I look and I see something, there's a subjective aspect to that. I'm sitting here and I see things from this particular point of view, but then I see things out there. And that there's a relationship and a connection between those two things, and it's in that connection that we are conscious. Right? So consciousness is only something that happens in relationship. You know, the classic phrase is expressed in dependent origination, chakuncha paticca rupe cha upajati chakra vijnanam. Dependent on eye and forms, there arises eye consciousness or visual consciousness. Dhyanang sangati paso, the coming together of the three is contact. Right? So our experience arises through the relationship and connection between internal and external. Right? So it's not a reductionist philosophy. Walking meditation, could you please briefly go over, or do I just do it as feels natural? I'd already talked about walking meditation, remember that yesterday or last night, maybe the person who asked the question wasn't here, maybe you just zoned out, I don't know, sometimes it happens. Just do it as feels natural? Yeah, sure, that sounds good enough. Just be mindful, okay? But look, because I did talk about it at some length last night, so if you weren't here or you missed that for some reason, maybe come and see me at the interviews or something like that to talk about it. So I won't go over it all again. But yeah, the main thing is just be mindful. Okay. How do we avoid looking for what seems like contradictions in the teachings? For example, how does impermanence fit with karma? Okay. So it's an interesting point. It comes back to the question I made before about the critical mind, right? So there's a difference between a mind that's looking for faults, okay, and a mind that's trying to understand. All right, just notice that two differences, right? So when we're looking for faults, this is in Pali it's called uparambhacitta. So the Buddha said, if you're listening to the Dhamma with a mind that's looking for faults, right, then you'll never really understand it, okay? And I think there's something very profound in that, right? That we understand things through empathy, through compassion. Yeah? And if you're engaging, even with the teaching, if you're engaging in the teaching with just wanting to find fault in it, then you never really understand what's happening. This is a point that was made. There was a dialogue that was done a number of years ago where the Dalai Lama was invited by this Christian group to comment on a number of Bible passages. And they made a transcript of that and published that as a book. I can't remember what the name of the book was now. But it was, of course, very interesting, as you'd expect, and he gave a commentary on a number of different Bible passages. I remember one of the remarks that somebody said at the end, that they noted how compassionate the Dalai Lama's response was. I mean, the Dalai Lama is a very sharp intellectual, yeah. And he could very easily have, you know, torn these passages apart. He could have been very critical of it, you know. He could have analyzed it from numerous points of view of Buddhist philosophy and shown metaphysical contradictions in them and so on, if he'd wanted to, right? Anybody can do that, right? So it's not difficult to do. But he handled them with care and with compassion, right? When I say it's not difficult to do, I'm not making a reference to the Bible specifically. I just mean with any philosophical or scriptural passage, spiritual passage, it's easy to find faults if you want to. So he didn't do that. He handled it with compassion and tried to enter into the text and tried to really understand what was going on from the point of view of those people who are participating in there. Yeah? This is actually something which is part of his training, both in the Mahayana path, which emphasizes compassion so much, but also specifically in the Gelug monastic training, where they part of the part of the foundations of their monastic training is training in debates, and during the debate they have to study and understand both sides of the debate, so that you can have two monks who might be debating a point, and then they might be told to switch at any moment, so you have to immediately drop the side that you're debating and take up the side that the other person's debating, right? So this is kind of developing that intellectual flexibility to be able to do that. And so you're putting yourself in that other person's shoes, and so you could see that was, you know, that's an expression of compassion. So the same thing when we're listening to the Dhamma, yeah, we should try to listen with compassion and try to find meaning in it, okay? But that doesn't mean that there aren't problems, and it doesn't mean we should ignore the problems or deny them when they exist. But we should approach the problems with the thought of, well, how do I understand this better? Is this a real contradiction or is it not? And so we can ask and we can inquire. Sometimes these things might only be on the surface. Sometimes somebody might make a mistake. Sometimes it's our own mistake. It's our own misunderstanding. And so if we can't resolve the question ourselves, then it's good to ask and to find the answer to it. This is something which is praised repeatedly, very often in the suttas by the Buddha, that people would ask questions to clarify the meaning of things, and actually is regarded as one of the fundamentals of Dhamma education. Very interesting, like when you look at how, I'm going on a little bit answering this question, but anyway, if you look at how the Dhamma is taught and presented in the suttas, there's a whole education program which is outlined there, which is actually a really fantastic education program. First of all, you hear it, and then you memorize it, okay? So you have to actually learn things, memorize them. You reflect on them. Yeah. So again, it's not just rote memorizing, but you reflect on the meaning of it. Yeah. And then you discuss it, right, with others. You ask questions about the many doubtful points. Yeah. And so that's the role of the teachers and so on, the elders, is to be able to discuss and answer those and clarify those doubts. Yeah. And then you put it into practice, right? So you apply those lessons to your own experience. Yeah? Isn't that a wonderful richness and depth to the way that the Dhamma education is pursued? And it's a depth which, you know, if you look at the way education is done in the world, you can only see one or two of those things. Yeah? It's very partial. And the way that the Dhamma is approached is very full. Anyway, so just to look at this one particular thing, how does impermanence fit with karma? It's a very good question, because karma, we do an act now, we experience the result later, right? But on the other hand, everything's supposed to be impermanent. So if I do the act now, shouldn't that just disappear, right? So this actually is one of the fundamental problems in Buddhist philosophy. And it's a problem which was addressed in different ways by the different philosophical schools. Which shows that it's not something, it shows it is a genuine issue, right? It doesn't show that it's a, you know, problem understanding, but it shows it's a genuine issue which has been approached by many different Buddhist philosophers over the years. So the important thing to remember here is that the doctrine of karma is the doctrine of cause and effect, okay? So a cause happens at one time and effect happens later. The cause doesn't determine the effect, okay? So it doesn't fix what's going to happen as the outcome of it. Right? But it does shape the effect, it influences it. So how karma will fruit depends on all kinds of different other conditions. So if we think of karma as like a seed, you know, you can plant a seed. We know that if we plant a mango seed, you're going to get a mango growing up, right? So we know that much. But, well, if we don't know if it's a mango, we know that if it sprouts, it will be a mango. We don't know, maybe it won't sprout. Maybe it'll just fall on barren rocks and it won't sprout at all. Sometimes that's what happens to karma, right? It just doesn't reap its fruits because there's no conditions for it. Sometimes it might only grow a little bit because there's not enough nutrition in the soil. Sometimes there's not enough water. What if it's eaten by ants and so on? Is it going to be a lot of fruit or a little bit of fruit? Is the fruit going to be sweet or sour? Right? How long will it take to grow? How big will the tree grow? None of these things are fixed by the act simply of planting the seed. They're all influenced by lots of other conditions. So the karma is just something which acts and which will reap some kind of fruit, but it doesn't determine what those fruit is. Okay? So, I could talk about that at a lot of length, but I'll just leave it at that for now. Hopefully that's at least given you a beginnings of an answer to that problem. Okay. Next question. Dear Arjun, I feel fear when I say, may I be happy? Please advise. Really? You feel fear? Why? Why do you feel fear? I don't know. Why would you feel fear? Are you afraid of not being happy? I don't know. Well, anyway, there's nothing to be afraid of. I know that much. I'm really not sure. I'm not quite sure how to answer that without knowing more about where the fear comes from and so on. If it's still a problem for you tomorrow, come and see me and we can talk about it. But I wouldn't like to comment too much on that at the moment. See how you go. Try it out another couple of times and see if the fear goes away. If it still stays on, then come and see me. Okay. Dear Bhante, according to the Buddha's teaching, when or what is the view about animal testing for a cure to human sickness? How would one test it? How would one something? How would one react if the testing is to cure a relative of the Buddha? Practicing in metta. Thank you. Okay, so animal testing. First of all, I have to declare my bias. I was a member of Animal Liberation for several years in the 1980s, so I don't like animal testing. I think animal testing is grossly... most animal testing is for completely trivial purposes. Okay? Shampoo is tested on animals. You don't need to test shampoo on animals. Your shampoo that you have already is fine. Just FYI, right? Toothpaste, dishwashing liquid, soap, toilet cleaners, right? I mean, toilet cleaner, you know, you get a bunny rabbit, you stick it in a cage, you pull its eyes open and you pour toilet cleaner its eyes to see what happens, right? You don't need to do that, okay? You can make your toilet clean. We never need to use another animal for testing any of these things. And that's millions of laboratory animals every year that are used for these kinds of completely trivial purposes, okay? If we come to medical purposes, then there are also millions of animals killed, and there are a lot of grey areas in medical testing for multiple reasons, which is probably... I'm not an expert, but I know that there are a lot of grey areas there. For example, there are a lot of things which are tested which, the testing is driven by profit motive rather than by genuine wanting to help people. This is one problem. There's all this idea, we do this testing, right, so we can make this drug and then we can save these people, right? And this is, okay, that's the argument, and it's a compassion, argument for compassion and all of those kinds of things. Surprisingly enough, in the vast majority of cases, right, those drugs are being tested for illnesses for rich people who can afford to pay for the drugs. Whereas in fact, we could save millions and millions of more lives by buying some mosquito nets and giving them to poor people who are going to die of malaria, right? So this whole kind of argument that we need to do this out of compassion, I think, is flawed. actually, if we step back from it and say, how do we ease the suffering that humans have through illness and sickness? Okay, investing more money in animal research, to my mind, is not the most effective way of doing that in most cases. Nevertheless, it is what we do, so what should our response be to it? Personally, I think we should avoid it wherever possible. Are there some cases when it might be justified? I don't know. I find it hard to think of cases when that would be the case. Certainly, we're moving to situations where there are new methodologies that will hopefully supplant animal testing as much as possible, particularly computer modelling on one hand, and also stem cells on the other hand. Okay, so both of these, I think, offer a lot of promise to be able to replace much of what we do today in terms of animal testing. That's not solving the ethical problem, it's kind of avoiding it, but still, sometimes that's the best thing that we can do. And at the end of the day, you know, leaving all of those things aside, if we still come back to that question, I think the most crucial thing is that we have to admit that there is a genuine ethical dilemma, that the lives of those animals who are being tested in the laboratory have an intrinsic value and worth, and they can't be regarded merely as an object, right, to be used in the laboratory. And we have to consider that carefully with every life that is taken. And to not treat it as something that's just, you know, it's just a number. And I don't think that's the case. And we've seen some, I think, great strides in recent years, or at least minor strides in recent years, with the release of a lot of the chimpanzees. And there seems to have been a massive shift towards in the use of primates, at least, in animal testing. And I don't know if you've seen the incredibly moving videos of the laboratory chimps who are released for the first time into the sunshine. Have you seen that? And you can go on YouTube. It's just amazing. These poor chimps have been their whole life locked in a laboratory, and then they're kind of let out for the first time, and they go out into the sun. They're like looking around this yard, and there's actually sunshine and space to move, and they look, and they're like, they sort of come back. They're kind of scared, and they, you know, and then they one of them jumps out, and then just a minute later, they're all jumping around and they're playing, and it's just unbelievable. And you see how these are such intelligent and sensitive beings. They don't exist in order to serve as test tubes for us. I'm sorry, that's not their purpose in life. They're sentient beings, and we should respect them as sentient beings. Okay. What's the difference between Bhante and Ajahn? Oh, that's a nice, simple question. Thank you for that. Bhante is... Well, they're both honorifics. They both mean basically the same thing, mean kind of venerable or something like that. Bhante... I personally prefer Bhante because it's a Pali word, and that's what the monks in the time of the Buddha used. And it's also a bit of an international word, like you find that sort of the monks in kind of Malaysia and Indonesia and a few different countries tend to use the word Bhante. India as well, they use Bhante. Whereas Ajahn is specifically a Thai word, which is actually a kind of a reduced version of the Pali word Acharya, meaning teacher. One of the problems with the word Ajahn is that I think it's a bit problematic because, first of all, in Thai it just means teacher. So if you're a school teacher, you're Ajahn, right? So we've kind of adopted it from Thailand, but we don't really use it the same way that the Thais do. I personally prefer Bhante, but it's not a big deal, obviously. Right, excellent. When your mind wanders away during meditation, what do you do? Just don't do anything. Who told you that you were the boss of your mind? Your mind wanders away, it's all right. Let it wander. Minds wander, that's all. That's all. Don't worry about it. But you just be peaceful and be calm. And the more you be peaceful and calm, then the mind will come back. If your body and your where you are is a still and calm and peaceful and warm and loving place, then your mind will want to come and settle down in that place. Think about that. Imagine that you've got a dog or something like that that likes to wander off around the neighborhood. You know, how do you keep the dog there? Well, you can tie it up on a string if you like and keep it there. Okay, and sometimes you have to do that, but it's not a very nice way to live if you're a dog, you know. And the other way to do it is you just make sure that he's happy. Make sure that he's fed well, make sure that he's given plenty of love and attention and so on. And then he'll want to come and stay home because it's a nice place to be. Yeah, so that's really the best way of keeping the mind there. When you're doing walking meditation, do you have to walk very slowly? I tend to walk a bit fast. Yeah, don't worry about it. Walk at whatever speed's comfortable for yourself. Usually, actually, you find people are often familiar with the Burmese and the Zen style where they walk very slowly in walking meditation, but actually in the Thai forest tradition, the monks walk quite quickly in walking meditation. Handwriting this one. Where does it say letting go is more powerful than greed? Where does it say that? I do not know. I'd have to think about that. I assume you're looking for a sutta reference. I would have to go and do a bit of research. I can't think of anywhere off the top of my head. Sorry about that. What does sadhu mean? Sadhu means sadhu. It's good. It's well. Yay. I fall asleep. We're meditating. Help! I might be one in the room going zzz right now. Well, if you are, there's not much point in answering the question, is there? Fall asleep during meditation. Okay, so falling asleep during meditation, something will happen to everyone sooner or later. So don't worry about it too much. If you fall asleep from time to time in your meditation, it just means you're probably a bit tired. So don't worry about it. It's only a problem if it happens regularly. If you find every time you're sitting that you're falling asleep, your mind's drifting and you're going up, then that can be a problem because it can become a habit. And you can learn to associate meditation time means falling asleep time. And that's probably not a good thing. So if you find that you're falling asleep every time in meditation, you probably want to do something about that. So my suggestion is this. To break that habit or to stop that tendency of the mind, first of all, get whatever it is you're sitting on, your seat or your meditation cushion or something, and put it at the end of a walking meditation path. Okay, so then do walking meditation for a while, maybe 20 minutes, a half an hour or something like that, and then very mindfully just sit down to meditate. And only sit for 5 minutes, right? Keep a clock next to you so you don't go more than 5 minutes. Sit for 5 minutes, watch your breath or whatever, get up again, walk again. Sit again for 5 minutes, get up again, walk again. Sit again for 5 minutes. Do that a few times. Then when you feel comfortable doing that, then increase it to 10 minutes. And then increase it to 15 minutes. And then increase it to 20 minutes and so on. Until you find that when you sit, that sleepy feeling is coming on. Okay? And when you feel that sleepy feeling coming on, just stand up straight away. Okay? Don't sit through it, just stand up straight away and walk. And then so just train yourself to sit for only short periods of time and not let that sleepy feeling come. Okay? So if you do it like that, then you can break that conditioning in your mind that associates meditation with sleepiness. Okay? And so if you do that for long enough, and you should be able to train yourself so that you can sit without letting the sleepiness come. Okay. So that's a very, very, very good technique. All right. So that's all the questions. Oh, that's good. Managed to get them all done. So hopefully we'll have another batch tomorrow. Oh, we're going to have time to answer them tomorrow? Maybe not. Looks like, oh, probably not actually. Anyway. Okay. So that's enough for this evening. And we'll see you here tomorrow at 5:30. Okay, very good. Let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.